Brigadier Calvert, reel 18.
Yes. Well, I was saying, this chap, Brigadier Michael Roberts, who was one of the authors of the official history of war in Burma, he had been Slim's chief intelligence officer and at one period. But he, as I have mentioned, he'd got this Zid against Wingate. How he'd got it, I don't know. He might have had some personal loss of an officer or relation under Wingate, which might have turned him. But he had this appalling attitude to, I might call it unmilitary attitude to Wingate. And Slim had, when Wingate's death, had written, which is all in the books, a very laudatory obituary of Wingate. But when it comes to his writing in Defeat to Victory, he changes his mind, not only on his attitude, but on particular points, like the fly-in, and so on. And I found out, in fact, I was in Australia, met him, it was Michael Roberts was with Slim and was his ghost writer for a large part of his book, Defeat into Victory. And when I met Slim later, he was very good to me, always has been, and when he was staying at Windsor Castle, he did say, I asked him about this, and he did say that the book had taken a different turn to what he wanted about Wingate. And he said, but I haven't the time to just go into all the details and so on. I had to leave it to others. And some paragraphs got in which I was not fully agreed. And he told me that before his death. And so this, in every book written about the campaign or about Wingate or Slim or this, that, this always comes up. But I mentioned that because Michael Roberts appeared to be the sort of nigger in the woodpile. Whether he was urged on by other people elsewhere, I just don't know. But there it is. The all these two campaigns have been written up again and again. I suppose there are about 50 books or more in which they've been mentioned. And I think when I went out to stay with my brother in Budapest 2 or 3 years ago, he has been the he belongs to ICI, and he's been the sales manager in Eastern Europe, in different countries in Eastern Europe, for 10 years or more, and I stayed with him in Budapest, where he was learning the language and had been there for about 2 years. And he had told the military attaché that I was coming. And the military attaché very kindly arranged a party for me in which there, I think, were 13 other military attachés from both sides of the Iron Curtain. And it was very pleasant, and their wives. And they, like proper military attachés, had done their homework, and they talked to me and were very polite to me, very nice to me, and they asked me questions about the Chindits and Wingate, and of course a bit about the SAS, but their main interest was the Wingate operations in Burma. I mentioned that because there's a worldwide interest in Wingate which a lot of people in the British Army don't realise. And they asked, for instance, the Russians. Military attaché mentioned the fact that they had their guerrillas operating behind the German lines, and they operated very much the same lines as ourselves, except they didn't fly in. They did fly in artillery, they've used up a lot of their aircraft supplying the guerrillas, and they said that they thought their operations were in parallel with Wingate, except, and I'm going to forget his name, but one of the great German generals on the Russian front said that he was not defeated by the Russian infantry or armoured divisions, but it was the guerrillas behind his lines which had played merry hell with his lines of communication, which had forced his withdrawal. So I think there is a tendency to rewrite history and not give due credit for guerrillas or people who operate or non-conformist units, because people feel that that will upset the army and is not the sort of party line. I think that there was a lot of antipathy against Wingate after the war. Especially, one must realize there's a large number of officers who'd been prisoners of war and who'd got promoted during their prisoners of war. I found them in Malaya when I was operating them. I felt that a lot of them, I think, felt that they had missed out and didn't know what to do. And the only thing they remembered what to do was how to run their officers' messes. And this is a diversion. But I remember operating in Malaya with a company commander, and everything had gone well, and we'd got the Chinese bandits or guerrillas on the run, and we'd put blocks, and we'd ambushed the guerrillas, and they were coming down the end, and suddenly the company commander says, "I've got to go back, that's the finish." I said, "What do you mean?" I said, "We've got them on the run." He said, "I've got a direct order from my battalion commander that I must attend the next guest night," when he insisted that all officers attend the guest night. And so he packed up. I told General Harding, I was operating for General Harding all over the place, and he was furious. But this officer had been a prisoner of war, and he got promotion whilst he was a prisoner of war, and he'd come out as colonel, and I think this is all he knew what to do. And I did sympathise, I put this up, I better not, that there are obviously some very, very good officers who have been prisoners of war, and very good, and become good officers afterwards. But I did sympathise with the Japanese and Russian attitude, which is that if a man is taken prisoner, he has lost his nationality. And in the Russian army, they had to do 2 or 3 years working for their country as labour before they could regain their nationality. And Japanese, of course, anybody who'd been taken prisoner was useless, and they tried to commit suicide and did anything else of that nature. But I mentioned that because that when the war finished, there was the Chindits were treated as anathema, and people had to try to conceal the fact that they were Chindits, because it otherwise blocked their promotion. And it took a long time for the British Army and the Staff College and elsewhere to get interested again. And when they found out what Chindits achieved, we made plenty of mistakes. It's more that I'm talking about the tactics and the strategy. They become more and more interested. I was asked down myself to the Staff College to give lectures, give talks, and so were others over the years. And now, 40 years later, I think there's been a revival in the interest of these, because they have found that in nuclear warfare or warfare as it's likely to be waged in Europe. Brigades and others will get isolated, and they will have to adopt much the same frame of mind, I would say, more than tactics and strategy, of the Chindits, so that they will go on fighting whether they're surrounded or not. Also, I most earnestly like to say what I wrote in 1945, I think it's the August edition of the Army Quarterly, that we should adopt supply by air, by pilotless aircraft, something on the lines, I said then, of the V-1 bomber, which is very cheap, had only one moving part, and it could be sent off by I forget what the Army Service Corps called nowadays, be directed onto a unit, and so you wouldn't have all this nonsense of huge lines of communication with building of bridges and roads and so on. One of the great advantages of the Wingate Brigades is that 95% of the men were potential Jap killers, and we had practically no administrative personnel within the brigade. It's made us very, very strong and very, very confident and sure of ourselves. And I feel that there's always that worry in war of your tail. Well, if your tail is, for instance, an automatic sending of supplies which would land, in which the aircraft was, I could either be drop its nacelle and go home again, directed home, or would be considered expendable, that units in the field could operate with enormous independence and confidence and attacking spirit. The other thing, of course, is signals. Well, I'm told that the first part of the war will be a I've got it now, yes. It will be an electronic war in which both sides will try and flatten out all the electronics of the other side. I don't know sufficient about that. And that may make signals communications very difficult. But it won't excuse any people surrendering. The third thing, of course, is evacuation of casualties. And I just don't know the answer to that unless we have Red Cross light aircraft which are allowed in by both sides, or some convocation where you look after the other side's wounded, like the Japanese looked after ours. But I have mentioned this supply by pilotless aircraft, and the only people who've taken it up are was Israeli officers and the French. But I hope that we will go ahead with it. Now, I won't say any more at the moment. I may stop.
Going back to what you were saying about your attitude towards POWs, it's a much harder attitude than the traditional British one towards being captured by the enemy.
Yes, I think that is so, because I've been fighting against a harder enemy. And I think it should still be considered a disgrace to be taken prisoner unless you have been wounded or incapacitated. I would like to take up, when I'm at the Staff College next week, this question of when a general surrenders. When the unit in Calais surrendered, a great friend of mine escaped, about three officers I know escaped, and they got away. But they weren't court-martialed. When Singapore surrendered, this General Bennett got away to Australia, and he was eventually sort of court-martialed as to why he escaped. He wanted to come back and tell them all the defects of the armies and tactics. I had a sergeant major later in the SAS, 22nd SAS, which I formed in Malaya. Now, he had he'd been in the artillery, and he had got some boats which he felt to escape across to Sumatra. When the surrender came, he escaped with some of his men over to Sumatra. They wandered over Sumatra, had no maps. They got captured again by the Japs, and then he escaped a second time. He went on the North Sumatra shore, filled his a prow with coconuts, so as he got and had a dar to open the D-A-H, to open the coconut, and he decided to sail to Colombo. He set forth, and after a few days, he was very fortunate to be picked up by, I think it was HMAS Hobart. In a roundabout way, he was brought back to India, and he was court-martialed and reduced to the ranks of gunner for escaping. And I think this is disgraceful. When Wingate heard of him later on, he made him a battery sergeant major, and he became... He fought in the Chindits. Later on, he had, incidentally, he had been a heavyweight boxer, and he's a fine chap. And I wrote an obituary about him in the Times, one of the few, a full column in the Times, one of the few, I think, RSMs who got an obituary column in the Times. Now, I think that people's minds should be made clear as to what you should do when you escape, when you surrender, and what the orders are. At one time we are told that the duty of an officer is to escape. At another time he's supposed to surrender and obey orders and stay with his men. But then in the prisoner of war arrangements at The Hague, officers are separated from the men. At the end of the war, I was sent over to Norway, and I commanded a Bergen zone, an area almost the size of Scotland. And there we had, apart from about 50,000 Germans, we had about 50,000 Russians, ex-prisoners of war. And we saw to it, well, this is the SAS in this thing, the 1st Airborne commanded the other zones. And first of all, we gave as much food as we could to the Russians because they'd suffered. And I went round them all, and they had no officers. They said their officers were killed. But a number of men said, actual fact, they'd taken off their stripes and they were officers. And their will was rather broken, but otherwise they were well behaved and so on. My men volunteered to give up all their rations to the Russians. And we had some liaison officers who'd been white Russians or this, that and the other. And... So the language problem was, and I used to go around and see them, and they used to sing God Save the King when I turned up. Later on, a Russian military mission arrived. To begin with, they were antipathetic to us, but then we got to know each other. The chief medical officer had been in the Tsar's army, and we got on very well. The Norwegians allowed them on a chit system. They had no money to go to the cinema, and I opened forces canteens, which were all the drink which the Germans had looted, and the Russians were allowed to go and have drinks, and they behaved themselves well. They made their own military police and behaved very well in these Allied forces canteens, until eventually some KGB troops came along, and they were absolutely poisonous, and they accused me of subjecting the prisoners of war to Western influence. Amongst other things, I had tried to introduce a postcard system so they could send a postcard to their last known address of their family and saying, I am well. The Russians put a stop to that, the KGB put a stop to that, and we had trouble ever afterwards. They locked them all up, and on the whole, things went well. But these were prisoners of war, ex-prisoners of war. And there again, I was asked, I had, in the SAS, we had different nationalities who had joined the SAS, from Austria and here, there and everywhere, and Foreign Legion and so on. They told me a lot of these people wanted to escape, because if they went taken in by the Russians, they'd be killed. They found out who they were. So I sent a thing saying, you'd allow them to escape. Don't take any notice. If they go across to Sweden or jump on some ships or this, that and the other. So a lot of them did escape, and they weren't killed off by the Russians like the ones in Austria were later on. The numbers weren't very large, but there were some. But I think I'd like to know what, I'd like it to be studied or revised or whatever it is, what orders are for prisoners of war, because in the next war there'll be people be asked to surrender, and I think in the 1939-45 war there were far too many surrenders in all over the place, and except possibly in Hong Kong, where the people did fight much more, the last man, the last round, they had a higher percentage of casualties before they surrendered than any other ways. But in Singapore, we surrendered about 130,000 men to a force of about 70,000. In their surrenders in the retreat from Burma, and of course there was Dunkirk and Tobruk and so on. I think there are far too many surrenders, and I think that we should imbue a spirit of fighting on.
What do you think was the psychology behind these too easy surrenders?
One, I would say, is the regular army, who rationalizes things, and like a chessman saying, right, we give up. This is all part of the thing of war. One, the other thing, of course, is tiredness amongst the commanders. I do say this again and again, tiredness and lack of sleep makes cowards of us all. I don't believe in the captain of the ship staying on board the bridge, this is an analogy, for 4 or 5 days without sleeping and be proud of it. He should trust his second commands. When my battalion commanders got all jittery, and I would find it, they would wrap their battalions around them for their own protection rather than to put them in a proper tactical situation. I would get my chief medical officer to go around and suggest they had a good night's sleep and give them a sleeping pill, and they'd wake up and they'd be twice as good afterwards. I think I think it's tiredness of staff and everybody else. They just give up. We should never have surrendered in Singapore, and Wavell gave definite orders that Singapore should not surrender. He later said to me he couldn't understand it. But people make excuses saying it's a civil population or something like that. It rains every 24 hours in Singapore, so there's no lack of water there. But Also, I don't think we should have tried to defend it as a city. We should have done what MacArthur did. He didn't try to defend Manila, but he did his defences also. Wellington had done the same in the lines of Torres Vedras, which MacArthur copied very completely. We should not try to defend cities unless we are willing to kill off every civilian whilst defending that city. Form our defences elsewhere. I definitely think that I remember at White City we had some of the Japanese floated in a lot of papers telling us to, suggesting we should surrender, and one paper was brought to me. And I said, rather dramatically during a bombardment, that we will stay here. I can say you often heard it in books and things, we'll stay here, the last man, the last round. I always remember this because a very bright young signals officer, I said, any questions? He said, yes, if you're the last man and you fired the last round, can you then surrender? He wanted some he wanted some hope. That made us all laugh and cheered us up. But I'm certain that it should be faced boldly, and people should be told that you know, when they can surrender and when they can't, and what happens when they do surrender. They should try and escape.
But presumably it's not just tiredness of COs, is it? It must be something to do with national character, if the Russians and Japanese have a different attitude.
Well, I think that was that was their orders, their makeup, I think. But it is so often officers say the men won't stand it. Maybe about married families or something like that. It isn't the men who don't stand, it's the officers who won't stand it. Time and again, I found out later on reunions and so on, that the young officers and men were willing to fight on and do this, that and the other. It was the older ones who were willing to give up. And it was, may have just been age, may have been, of course, they didn't want their men to suffer. And I must say this of the Indian Army. The Indian Army take tremendous interest in their men and their recruiting areas. They all know where the villages from which the men come from, they used to, and they used to go and visit those areas and so on. And they feel they have got a very great responsibility for the young men there. And they feel perhaps that they should not ask too much of them and have too many casualties. There's also talk of this trying to retain the regiment, not lose, so the regiment gets wiped out and so on. Americans have a different view. They use a division or battalion until it is wiped out, then they put another one in. It's rather like they do it with their tools. I operated building a railway in South Australia under command of an American thing, and I put a sort of maintenance system of all the bulldozers and everything. They said, no. Work them into the ground and we'll buy you another lot, and not to maintain them at all. And that's much the same as their battalions, which they used, which Vinegar Joe did with